Welcome, everyone, to A Time for Change. I'm Alexis Christophorus, along with Marquise Francis. As the NFL gears up for Super Bowl 56 this Sunday, the league continues to deal with fallout from the explosive class action lawsuit filed by former Miami Dolphins head coach Brian Flores. Now, Flores was fired last month despite posting two straight winning seasons. He is suing the league and three teams, the Miami Dolphins, the New York Giants, and the Denver Broncos, alleging discrimination and racism in hiring practices. And that's despite the NFL's longstanding Rooney Rule, requiring teams to interview candidates of color for head coaching and senior positions.
And after initially rebutting the claims, saying they were without merit, the NFL and its commissioner, Roger Goodell, have since acknowledged the state of the NFL's locker rooms, calling the lack of diversity, quote, unacceptable. Adding, quote, "We understand the concerns expressed by Coach Flores and others this week. Here to talk about the latest in the Flores case and what the NFL's about face means is N. Jeremy DeRue, professor of law at American University and the author of Advancing the Ball, Race Reformation and the Quest for Equal Coaching Opportunity in the NFL. Professor DeRue, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Look forward to it.
Great. And so just to jump into things, in the week since Flores announced that lawsuit, two more minority head coaches have been hired by the NFL, both Lovie Smith, the black man in Houston Texans, and also Mike McDaniel, a mixed race man in Miami Dolphins. So was this a little bit of cause and effect? And does the fact that two more head coaches change the optics at all of this Flores lawsuit?
No, so there's no way to know if it was cause and effect, right? There's no way to prove it one way or another. What we do know is that there has been, over the history of the NFL's efforts to increase people of color among the ranks of head coaches, there have been fits and starts, situations where numbers have gone way up and then they've come way down. They've gone up and there's been backsliding. So I don't think too much should be taken from these two hires. Really thrilled about them. Very happy for Coach McDaniel. Very happy for Coach Smith. I don't think anybody should conclude that as a consequence of these two hires, Flores' suit is irrelevant or that the problem is solved.
Professor, from the moment this class action lawsuit was filed, it seems we keep hearing the same thing. The burden of proof lies with Brian Flores. We've seen the text messages that he referred to between himself and Coach Belichick. How difficult a battle will this be for him to prove what he is alleging?
So it's an uphill battle. It's always an uphill battle when you're challenging an employer with respect to employment discrimination, because courts tend to be rather deferential to employers with respect to their subjective decision-making as to who's right for the job, who has that it, that certain quality. And so it'll be an uphill battle. I mean, what Flores has done is quite effectively laid out in his complaint double standards and headwinds that have been a real problem for African-American head coaches over the course of many, many years. And then he lays out his own experiences, as you mentioned, in Denver, in Miami, in New York. And he wants to wrap those experiences around the broader nationwide, league-wide double standards and bring a racial discrimination claim. He'll have to prove to the court that his particular instances in New York, in Miami, in Denver were race-based. That'll be his challenge.
Mm-hmm. And Professor, as much as the government has rules in place to protect against monopolies, it feels as though the NFL is one in and of itself. They make their own rules and they govern themselves. So how much could they actually stand to lose in this lawsuit?
Well, I think they could stand to lose a great deal. I mean, I think they could stand to lose the appearance of being a league that is committed to diversity in a world that is day by day, it seems, week by week, month by month, recognizing the need for an exploration of diversity and a commitment to equal opportunity. So that's one thing they could lose. They also could lose. There's something else that Coach Flores mentioned in his lawsuit. He talked about an allegation that the owner of his club, the Dolphins, when he was a coach, asked him to lose games on purpose in exchange for $100,000 per game lost. And so that allegation is now a part of the lawsuit. And if the NFL loses the sense among viewers, among fans, that each competition really is about every given Sunday anybody can win, then the product they're offering is very, very different. And I think they really could be in a situation where they lose market share to other major sports leagues in the country.
I'm glad you brought that up because I feel like that's getting lost in the sauce a little bit. This allegation that, which is a serious allegation, Flores says that ownership was trying to incentivize him to throw games in essence to guarantee that the team would get a better top draft pick. How much does Flores perhaps leave himself open to a defamation case here if he can't prove it effectively?
If you can't prove it effectively, then there's always a possibility, but truth is a defense. And so unless it can be made clear that there is no truth in what he said, I think he's pretty safe with respect to some sort of a counterclaim. And allow me to add that I think his lawyers would have vetted that out very carefully before they put that the allegation in the complaint.
Yeah, we would absolutely hope so. Given that this is a class action lawsuit, that means other people can jump in. Thus far, no one has necessarily raised their hand fully, and folks have been rather resistant. What do potential plaintiffs in this case also have at stake? Because we've seen what's happened in the past by Colin Kaepernick allegedly being blackballed from the league for also standing up. Is there there also a sentiment that that could also be the case for others that jump in?
Yeah, without question. You know, I think, you know, let's just focus for a moment on how whatever you feel about Brian Flores' lawsuit, how brave it was to bring the suit. As I said, it's well recognized in the community that there are double standards, and there have been double standards for years with respect to getting a head coaching job for African-American head coaching candidates. So it's not that these statistics haven't been around. It's that nobody has decided to come forward and assert the case publicly and legally. And so Flores has done that, and it took tremendous courage. And it'll take courage from others to join the class. There is the risk that you might not be able to coach again in the league. We hope that's not the case. We know that Brian Flores wants to coach again. We know that he loves to coach. I hope that it won't be a situation where he's viewed as no longer a viable candidate. But that's always a risk with a suit like this. And I think others joining the class face a similar risk, unfortunately.
I mean, we know that Flores was one of three people up for the head coaching job with the Texans. We know that didn't work out. They actually wound up going a whole different way and decided to hire from within. But, you know, from when you look at other cases like Flores's, do you believe that he has, you know, sort of committed career suicide? And may he just have to look outside football for his next career move?
Again, you know, you would really hope not, but it's possible. I mean, if we, you know, we could spend a couple of hours exploring racial discrimination in American sport over the course of the last several decades, and we could point to many people who have challenged leagues with respect to racial discrimination and who have not found themselves with jobs in the leagues again. So that possibility is there. Really hoping it doesn't come to pass here because Flores wants to coach. And he's a great coach, and the league is better with him in it as a coach.
And Professor, I just want to finish up a last question here. In your book, Advancing the Ball, I'm curious, what were your findings? And because of those, what is the actual, do you feel like Flores has a strong case?
So the findings of the book, I mean, the book basically explored the effort generally to increase diversity among head coaches of color. And the book actually focused heavily on the early years of the Rooney Rule. And in the early years of the Rooney Rule, it was very, very effective at increasing diversity in the league. One of the challenges that we've seen over the course of the last, I don't know, 5 to 6 years, is that it seems as though clubs are less willing, less interested in implementing the rule in a meaningful and intentional and deliberate manner. And when clubs haven't done that, the league has not come down on them with punishment. And so the consequence, I think, is a lot of people feel like the rule doesn't work. It's not that the rule doesn't work or that the rule's conceptually weak. The rule is conceptually strong, but the clubs have not implemented the rule. That's, I think, what we've seen. And that is, you know, among other things, what's led Brian Flores to sue.
Absolutely. And Jeremy DeRue, professor of law at American University, thank you so much for your insight this afternoon. Coming up, we'll hear from one CEO who says it's good business to invest in diverse-led companies. She'll explain that and more coming up after the break.
Welcome back to A Time for Change. The pandemic may have slowed most of us down, but not so for new companies trying to get up and running. In 2021, startups raised a record $329 billion, double the previous year. That's according to a new PitchBook report. But how much of that money went to diverse founders? Here to dive in is Bahia Yasmin Robinson, founder and CEO at VC Include. Bahia, thanks so much for being with us. So for people who are not familiar, this fund, it's a nonprofit membership-based fund. Tell us a little bit about the work you're doing there and how you're focusing on diverse businesses.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. So in 2018, we embarked on creating a platform to aggregate best-in-class fund managers with the express mission to amplify and accelerate investment both into the asset managers as well as into founders, right, into companies.
And following up there, you now have a fellowship for BIPOC fund managers. Tell us more about how that came about and what exactly you're looking for in those candidates.
Absolutely. So the fellowship on the VCI side was really designed to support first-time fund managers that were looking to invest in diverse founders, looking to invest in the new majority. You know, when I started this journey about 8 years ago, there were about 20 or so Black women, for instance, founders that had raised more than $1 million. And that number has increased now to about 100, but out of 23.5 million Black women, that number is still very low. And so what we realize is that asset managers or VC funds, private equity funds, specifically investing in underrepresented founders actually can increase that number on aggregate.
So Bahia, talk to me a little bit about the trends you've been seeing, especially during the pandemic, because we've talked a lot here at Yahoo Finance about the fact that women were disproportionately impacted by the pandemic and left the workforce in droves, and not all of them have come back. I'm wondering what the numbers are with regards to women and startups. What are you seeing there, and what's the appetite like for VC money for those businesses?
Well, what's interesting is that even though the number of investments into the VC space has increased exponentially, it's actually decreased for women. And so there's a challenge there in finding and investing in women-led startups. And again, the same thing is happening. What's happening is that corporates and other asset allocators are kind of standing up and saying, look, we want to invest in more asset management firms. We want to invest in more historically underrepresented founders. But it's happening incrementally. It's not happening as quickly as the market is investing in venture.
Yeah. And to that point, minority and women-owned firms manage only 1% of assets under management. Yeah. And yet they produce better investment returns than their non-diverse counterparts. What are folks really not understanding about the success is really plain in sight?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think, again, COVID has done an interesting thing, which has really spotlighted the fact that 1.3% of assets under management are managed by women and people of color together, right? So that's a huge market, a massive market opportunity. And so I think both the understanding that there's a correlation between asset managers, investment teams that are more diverse and women-led actually correlate into a higher investment into some of those funds that are led by new majority and women-led companies. And it's continuing to increase. I think on the allocator side, we get a lot of interest and a lot of, coming to us to pick our brains about how can corporates and other large financial institutions and asset managers and asset allocators continue to increase in investment into those types of founders.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there's a lot of folks watching really wanting to know how can they get involved. So what sectors are really hot right now? And are there any particular regions in the country where you're seeing business is really booming?
Midwest and Southeast is booming. Of course, there's been a lot of migration patterns coming out of some of the larger tier one cities into some of the smaller cities. And We don't know if that trend is going to increase over time or if there's going to be a bounce back to some of the larger urban centers like a New York, a Los Angeles, a San Francisco. But there's been a lot of kind of movement into the Austin, the Miami, the Atlanta markets. And so I think that's spreading some of the opportunity throughout the nation. But I think that we'll see in terms of trends, you know, obviously Web3, kind of crypto, decentralized organizations is going to be, you know, something that's going to continue to increase, as well as ESG. And one of the things that our franchise and a lot of our training and education centers around is environmental and social governance. So not just making sure that there's inclusion and diversity, both at the company level and at the fund manager level, but there's also an environmental consideration as well.
And sort of from your perspective there at VC Include, what would you say are some of the biggest obstacles, but also some of the biggest opportunities to diversify businesses?
Well, we know that the stats are very clear. You know, women-led firms outperform. New majority, or some folks still say minority firms, diverse firms outperform the market, both again, at the company level as well as at the fund manager level. And so there's several studies that prove that from all the major financial institutions and consulting firms that manage the $70 trillion of assets under management. I think that the massive opportunities investing into these firms and into these founders, picking the right teams, making sure that there's an ecosystem approach to investing, and making sure that there's more inclusion and therefore, you know, more opportunities to drive market rates or returns on the market, global markets.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Bahia Yasmin Robinson, founder and CEO of VC Include, thanks for being here today. Coming up next, Olympian and gold medalist Lindsey Vonn shares her thoughts on what it will take to increase diversity at the Winter Olympics. We're back right after this.
Welcome back to A Time for Change. If you're following the Winter Olympics, you're likely seeing a familiar face on your screen. Olympic gold medalist Lindsey Vonn is covering the games as a correspondent for NBC, trading her skis for the broadcast booth. I sat down and talked to Lindsey Vonn recently about diversity at the Winter Olympics and about her pivot from world-class skier to author and co-director of a new documentary about her childhood idol, skiing legend Peekaboo Street.
I mean, I met Peekaboo when I was 9 years old at an autograph standing in Minnesota, and she was really the person that inspired me to want to be an Olympian. You know, skiing wasn't on TV, and there was not a lot of tangible people that I could look up to in that way. And so Peekaboo is really the driving force of that. And, you know, to be able to co-direct with Frank Marshall and produce her documentary was such a full circle moment. And I was very honored to be able to do that project, and it's out on Peacock, so check it out. But she's such an amazing person, and I felt very lucky to be able to do that.
And diving a little bit more into the Olympics, this year the Beijing Olympics is touted to have the best gender equity of any Winter Olympics, to the tune of 45% women. Why has it taken so long?
Well, I think they need a different structure on how they're choosing the athletes. I'm incredibly excited about how many women are going to be on this Olympic team, but I think the selection process needs a bit of work. I know from the men's side, on the Alpine side, they're only taking 6 men, and they're leaving out a lot of team members that should be on the Olympic team because of this new gender equity rule, which again is great in theory, but I think there needs to be some adjusting, and we need to make sure it's fair all around. But I'm happy again that there's so many women on the team.
Yeah, and including equity there, you know, in terms of men and women, there's also the racial aspect of diversity. There's no secret the Winter Olympics are not very diverse. I know it took a long time for me to see someone who looked like me on the screen. And it wasn't until 2002, a Black person actually won a gold medal at the Winter Olympics. So what can be done for the games to increase their racial diversity?
I think it starts from the development phase, from, you know, junior sports, allowing access to different communities. I mean, I know skiing is such an expensive sport. It's very inaccessible. And in a lot of ways, I don't know how to change that because there just are, that's a difficult one to figure out. But I think starting from the ground up and having, you know, the Olympics or, you know, each NGB having their own, you know, program, diversity program, and giving access to different communities that don't have access. And we have a very long way to go to give that access to people who should have it.
I think one thing I really want to note is that you're actually putting in the work, right? You have the Lindsey Vonn Foundation where you give and you support women through scholarships, education, and athletics. So you talked about, obviously, you put your money where your mouth is, but why was this something important for you to make sure you're actually helping the next generation?
Well, for me, Peekaboo did so much. And honestly, it was meeting her for 90 seconds and it changed my life. So that was the premise of my foundation, is hoping that I can do the same for others and allow them access and give them, you know, encouragement and empower them to achieve their dreams. And so, you know, we've done camps across the country, Baltimore, New York, Colorado, California, Minnesota. So I'm really trying to give access and, again, empower them to accomplish whatever it is, not just in skiing, but in life, because we have sports scholarships, but we also have 50% educational based scholarships. And I'm heavily involved in STEM programs as well, which I think are really important for the next generation.
That 90-second chance meeting really changed Lindsey Vonn's life. And it was really amazing to hear from Lindsey talking about her childhood idol, meeting her and seeing how it really changed her life. And that documentary, Peekaboo, that Lindsey Vonn co-directed, is streaming right now on Peacock in the U.S. and Olympics.com elsewhere in the world. And at last count, I saw the U.S. was right outside the top 10 for medal count. So I'm definitely looking forward to them putting in some work in the week ahead.